Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
Well, the first half of Zechariah, chapter 6, is a symbol-laden prophecy of something in the future. And for Zechariah, just how far into the future was not calculable. The symbol consisted of four horses pulling chariots and dispersed from Jerusalem to the outermost parts of the known world. Now, we discussed that by all I can tell, the colors of the horses cannot be connected to anything concrete to help us decide if there is some direct correlation between their color and their mission or their characteristics. Rather, it seems to me that the different colors are simply a convenient means to sort out and add an identity to each horse. In the same way that identities are established for individual people by means of assigning proper names. So while color doesn't have any symbolic meaning about what each horse's exact meaning is, there is a common overall mission for the four as a group. And the mission is something that generally flies in the face of Christian orthodoxy. And so some church doctrine has been created to deal with this apparent contradiction. See, clearly, God the Father is sending these chariots out to incite war upon our entire planet. And since it is God who is doing it, it is officially holy war, meaning there are rules. And the rules are nothing like the man-made Geneva Convention. These holy war rules are covered by the biblical law of the ban, in Hebrew, the law of Harem. And rule number one is God makes the rules. Rule number two is that the enemy and all its possessions belong to God, and he'll decide what to do with it all. Now, since there is no tangible or material way to turn over a physical object or a person to God the same way we would give an object or a gift to someone, then the usual solution is to treat those physical objects and people similarly to the way an animal sacrifice is given to God. It is killed and burned up. And while that might seem controversial, even barbaric or unsavory to us, our solution is simply to refer back to rule number one and not fret over it. Now, this brings up the second matter. Christianity is very uncomfortable with a God who starts wars and kills people. And in response, Constantinian Christianity has evolved a doctrine that describes God as having but one attribute, love. If there is a second, it's mercy. There is left no room for a God of justice, punishment, or a taker of blood as retribution. Therefore, it is rather standard within Christianity, though not quite universal, to explain that Jesus has replaced his Father, so mercy has replaced severity. And therefore, since Christ is the new God, and all the rules have changed, then we can say that God's very nature and character has changed, even though the mantra that God never changes continues to be sung in countless songs and spoken from pulpits all over the globe. Now, I could spend a long time fleshing this out further, but I'll cut to the chase. This is a false doctrine that is nothing less than idolatry, and it mimics pagan religions. It is the remaking of Jehovah God into an image we prefer. It's a great sin, and it has led countless millions astray. Don't buy into it. Now, perhaps the greatest conundrum of this new idea that Jesus is the replacement God who is only love, peace, tolerance, and mercy is how to explain his coming return when the New Testament plainly says he leads a huge band of combatants in a war to retake the earth from Satan, riding sword in hand upon a white steed, wearing garments soaked in the blood of God's enemies. I'm going to leave that line of thought for the time being. I want you to see the definite connection to what God's true nature is versus that which has been contrived over the centuries with what's being foretold here in the first half of Zechariah chapter 6. So let's reread some of Zechariah. Open your Bibles to Zechariah chapter 6. We're going to start reading at verse 6 and then go on through the end. Zechariah chapter 6, starting at verse 6. The one with the black horses is going to go out toward the land in the north. The white horses have gone out after them, and the spotted have gone out towards the land in the south. Then the gray ones went out and were seeking to go and wander throughout the whole earth, when he said, wander throughout the whole earth, and they did wander throughout the whole earth. And then he called out to me and said, look, the ones going to the land in the north have given my spirit rest in the north country. And this message from Adonai came to me, take gifts from the exiles of Hildai, Toviah, and Yariah, who have arrived from Babel. Then you, it should be Bethel. And then you go down to the house of Yoshiah, the son of Zephaniah. Take silver and gold, make crowns, put one on the head of Yoshua, the son of Yosadak, the Kohen Hagadol, the high priest, and tell him, Adonai Zevaot says, there is a coming man whose name is Tzemach. He will sprout up from his place, rebuild the temple of Adonai. Yes, he will rebuild the temple of Adonai. He will take up royal splendor, sitting and ruling from his throne, and there will be a Kohen, a priest, before his throne. They will accept each other's advice in complete harmony, and the other crowns will be for Helem, Toviah, Yeriah, and Chen, the son of Zephaniah. Then they are to be kept as a memorial in the temple of Adonai. Those who are far away will come and help rebuild the temple of Adonai. Then you will know that it is Adonai Sefaot who sent me to you, and I will come about, provided you heed carefully what Adonai your God says. Now, war for our entire planet will be the order of the day, as is prophesied in verse 7. And while the epicenter of the coming conflagration will be Israel, clearly many other parts of the earth are not going to escape severe destruction, because the idea that the four chariots are going out to wander the planet symbolically describes just how broad will be the consequence of this future end times battle. That the north and the south are specifically called out is more about emphasis than exclusiveness. That is, it seems that the regions of Israel's historic enemies will be where the bulk of the war and destruction happen. Now, verse 8 is most challenging to discern. The first half of it says in straightforward words that it is God that is delivering this prophetic message, as opposed to, say, a courier or a surrogate, like an angel. It's the second half where the meaning is most difficult. It says something about God's spirit being taken to the north. Now, if I were to list six or eight of the most common Bible version translation of this verse, you would see 6 or 8 different understandings of it. And while some versions use the word spirit, others use the word wrath. And while some do this, the Hebrew word is ruach, which is nearly always rendered as spirit or wind. On the other hand, a rare form of this word is used a couple of times in the Bible, in Judges and Ecclesiastes, to indicate God's wrath. So which of these translations and interpretations is closer to correct in our Zechariah passage? Well, first, contextually alone, I rule out that we ought to translate ruach as wrath in this case. Rather, what is more likely being explained is that the presence of God is being carried, especially to the Northland, by these war chariots. Now, the most widely held belief among Bible commentators is this is speaking about God bringing angry wrath to the Northland. I don't think so. See, we must remember the era and the place that this prophecy is being written. The region is generally at peace, and Judah is not suffering oppression because the Persian Empire was now in full swing, and they had a somewhat enlightened view in governing their empire. Further, during this time, some 5 centuries before Yeshua would be born, the universal belief was that all gods were gods only over certain specified territories. The idea that one god would invade the territory of another god, well, that was a most serious thing. And most wars between nations were fought with a belief that this was actually a battle between gods for superiority. For Yahweh, God of Israel, to say that his spirit, his presence, would be carried to the Mesopotamian region where several other god systems were in operation meant a deliberate encroachment on the territories claimed by other gods. It also meant a claim of sovereignty over, or at least an intent to conquer, a certain nation or a region. This continues with the underlying theme of all Zechariah, in which Yahweh is declaring and claiming his authority, power, and universal sovereignty over every square inch of planet Earth. So the idea is God is planting his flag in a place where the false god systems say he doesn't belong. Here, then, the term ruach is neutral. That is, Yahweh is neither bringing wrath nor peace, only his presence. In fact, I think this revelation, while applying to the end time scenarios, is also meant to apply to Zechariah's era, and the returned Jews do find, or are hoping to find, some reassurance in this. That is, God is operating in the very place from which they have returned from exile. And with these startling words, the first series of prophetic oracles to Zechariah, all received in one night, are concluded. So now, beginning with verse 9. A new message is imparted to the prophet. And so we see the rather standard prophetic protocol announcing a new oracle. It's important to note that once again, God's formal name, Yahweh, is invoked as the one bringing this oracle to Zechariah, even though nearly all Jewish and English Bible versions obscure it. Verse 10 begins the actual message, which is in the form of an instruction for Zechariah to personally carry out. And it says this: take gifts from the exiles of Heldai, Tovia, Yariah, who have arrived from Babel, And then you go to the house of Josiah, the son of Zephaniah. And I will tell you that some say this Babel is Babel. Others will say it's Bethel. I think it's Babel for Babylon. Now, there are some nuances about the way the Hebrews presented grammatically that clouds exactly what's happening here. What is plain enough is that the Jewish exiles are offering a gift of high value to help advance something associated with the temple. Now, where it gets problematic is just who these three named people are and who they represent. The ambiguity allows for one or all to be Jewish exiles from Babylon, but not necessarily exiles that have returned. That is, recalling that probably no more than 5% of Jews living in former Babylon, now Persia, had actually migrated back to Judah. This passage could be speaking about an offering brought by Jews who had made the decision to remain living in Persia, which is why God ordered Zechariah to go to these people to receive their offering. Or some Hebrew language experts think that it could be that only the first name mentioned, Heldai, is a Jew who elected to remain in Persia, while the other two are living in Yehud among the returned exiles. And yet another option is that all three are Jews who had returned from exile, and the reality is we can't possibly know where each of these men fit within the overall Jewish community, but they clearly want to identify with the Holy Land and with the God of Israel. Now, most translations leave out an important nuance. When Zechariah is told to take the contributions those three men bring with them to the house of Josiah, the Hebrew includes the phrase Bayom Hahu, which means on that day. Now, while in many cases in the Bible that term is speaking about the end times Lord's Day, the Day of Judgment, that's not the case here. Here, it's only indicating the idea of immediacy. The very day the prophet collects the contributions, he is to go to the house of Josiah, son of Zephaniah, which in English is Zephaniah, and apparently deposit it there. There's no way for us to determine who exactly this Josiah is in English. However, clearly for Zechariah, to be told to take these funds to Josiah means this person had some well-known standing within the Judean community. Now, this was an important man. Perhaps he had some position as a sort of trusted treasurer for the community funds, but not as part of the local Persian government apparatus. If it had gone through official channels, it would necessarily have been taxed. Maybe he was a craftsman, proficient in working with gold and silver. This is because we quickly learned that the offering being brought, which is in the form of silver and gold that was standard for that time, was to be used to make an ornate crown, or as the grammar dictates, crowns, plural. We'll come back to that in a moment. Now let's back away from Zechariah's complex symbolism, yet again, to try and understand this as a Judean who was among the first to hear this prophecy in the 6th century BC would have. Trying not to be too repetitive, I must continue to impress the strange social and political situation the returned exiles from Babylon found themselves in. Zechariah is fully acknowledging this issue in the precise way he words God's oracle to him. Prior to the conquering of Judah by Nebuchadnezzar, soon after the entry into the 6th century BC, the Hebrews of Judah were still organized according to their traditional political and religious structure that had been set down by Moses 6 or 7 centuries earlier. The political side revolved around a king who had full authority to rule and judge as he saw fit, although it was always supposed to be in harmony with and within the boundaries of the law of Moses. The religious side, well, that revolved around a high priest who had full authority over the temple, all of its operations, the priests, and the Levite workers of every level, and it too was to operate within the boundaries of the Torah. He was also charged with teaching the law to the people. Now, the king had the most power by far over Israelite society. It was a royal office. Further, a king had much attachment to a temple in the sense that he was responsible to build one if it didn't exist, or to provide funds and impetus to improve upon it if it was already in operation. Now, the problem was that by Zechariah's day, even though the Jews were operating semi-independently, back home in Judah, now called Yehud by the Persians, the reality is that it was their Persian masters who owned the land. It was but one province among many in the Persian Empire. And so it was the Persian king who appointed the high priest, as well as who appointed someone to govern the province. This meant that for the first time since before King Saul, Judah, Israel, was ruled over by a person who was not a Hebrew monarch. Zerubbabel was a Jew, but he was a governor with limited power, not a king. In fact, for the first time in their history, the high priest, at that time a fellow named Joshua, received power to judge the people, something that until then belonged exclusively to the king. The bottom line was the high priest had more wide-ranging authority than their ruler, Zerubbabel, who was no more nor less than a Persian civil servant. Now, it's very hard for we moderns to grasp just how strange and unsettling this was for the Jewish community, including for Joshua and Zerubbabel. After having been exiled for 70 years because of their unfaithfulness to God, they were terribly worried that God was not present with them, because although they were back in their homeland, their sovereignty had not been restored, and for them this was a sign of possibly a continuing divine disfavor upon them. Therefore, they wondered if Joshua and Zerubbabel were illegitimate in God's eyes. And this was reflected in this strange new political and religious structure that now had overlapping areas of authority that had never before existed in their long history. They longed for a return to the comfort level of being governed in a way and under a structure as they'd always been. For them, that would be a comforting sign that God's favor had returned. Now, I'm sorry, I can't do any better than this to try to explain the background for the entire prophetic panorama of Zechariah's book, as well as for Haggai's. And I hope you can adjust your minds to see what is happening in these prophecies through that lens. It'll make far more sense because it actually approaches being quite logical. Well, at least if you were a 6th century Judean. Therefore, let's move on to verse 11 that introduces us to some of the most messianic-oriented passages in the Old Testament. Zechariah 6:11 says, "Take silver and gold, make crowns, put one on the head of Yahshua, the son of Jehozadak, the Kohen Hagadol, King James Version of this says, take silver and gold and make crowns and set them upon the head of Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Now, other than the King James Version butchering the high priest's father's name, do you see the important difference between these translations? The first one says a crown is going on the head of Joshua. The second says that them, plural, is to go on Joshua. So the very first thing we need to deal with is this. Is there one crown or is there two that is to be made? The second thing is, it is that both crowns, if there are two, are they to be placed on Joshua's head? Or is it that one of the two is, or is it that only one crown is actually being made and it is to be placed in Joshua's head? This whole thing has flummoxed Bible scholars for centuries. Now, the Hebrew word for crowns, plural, is atarot, because atarot is plural of atarah, which is singular for crown. In trying to make this verse harmonize within itself, scholars have suggested different solutions. The first being that atarot is a copyist error. It should be atarah. So we're only dealing with one crown. But if we do that, then other issues arise. The first is that crowns were always made of gold, not silver. In this era, silver was considerably more abundant than gold, therefore gold the more valuable. Thus, the crowns of kings were always made of gold. So was this crown to be made of some kind of a mix of gold and silver? But if there were two crowns, as the various ancient texts in Hebrew says it is, not one, were the two crowns to be made the same? Or was it that one was to be gold and the other silver? Does it matter? Yes, it does. And this is why I took a few minutes to review with you the major boiling social issue that was ever present among the returned exiles about how the Jews' new government in Yehud was structured and how much this troubled them. But now more issues. High priest didn't wear a crown of any kind. A crown was meant for royalty. So some Bible scholars say that a long time ago, some sloppy editing was done. And then, in fact, instead of Joshua being the recipient of the crown, it was supposed to be Zerubbabel. But for some reason, the editor removed Zerubbabel and instead put down Joshua. That is, this was an intentional redaction, not a simple error. Other Bible scholars suppose that originally both Zerubbabel and Joshua were mentioned because there were to be two crowns, not one, to be made. But somehow Zerubbabel got dropped out. Now, all I can tell you, there is not a shred of evidence to support any kind of redaction, error, copyist, or otherwise. Rather, there are indeed two crowns to be made. And for sure, Joshua's to get one of them. It's only that the reason behind this is so cloudy that Bible scholars have been unable to figure it out. Therefore, for them, this has to be an error. Yet when we better understand the circumstances of the times and how silver and gold were valued and the purpose of a crown, then it opens the likely probability that one crown was silver, the other one was gold, and Joshua likely would have received a silver crown, not a gold one. So might then Zerubbabel have received the second crown? The gold crown. Not likely. He was not a king. And if the Persian monarch would have heard of him wearing a king's crown, it would have been an open statement of rebellion. So then the question is, would Joshua have actually worn a crown? Now, according to the Torah, the high priest was to wear a mitre or a turban. I suspect that although Joshua was presented with a silver crown, it was more a symbol to possess than a piece of official apparel to wear. Now, the symbolism being that Joshua now carried more extensive powers than any prior high priest, some of those powers resembling the powers usually reserved for the king. But there was more, and that begins to emerge in verse 12. In verse 12, we read, "And tell him, Adonai Sevaot says, there is coming a man whose name is Zemach. He will sprout up from his place and rebuild the temple of Adonai." So, when the crown is handed to Joshua, or perhaps ceremonially based upon his head, the one who places it there, probably Zechariah, is to say, there is a man whose name is Zemach. He will sprout up from his place and rebuild the temple of Yehovah. It says God's name, not Adonai. Now, before we dissect those words, let's see another translation of this verse that is much more literal. "And say to him, thus said the Yehovah of hosts, behold, a man called the branch shall branch out from the place where he is, and he shall build the temple of Yehovah." Now, branch, shoot, sprout, all synonymous terms for Zemach. The words, behold a man, are to be pronounced to this shoot or sprout or branch. Pontius Pilate uttered these same words about Christ as the hours of Yeshua's life could now be counted in single digits. Now, this is a picture of Messiah. And most scholars, including Jewish scholars, agree that these might be some of the most important and poignant ever to be found in the Old Testament concerning him. So, because these words are said to Joshua, whose name, by the way, is identical to Yeshua's when spoken in Hebrew, then Joshua is portrayed in this prophecy as a type of Messiah. He is a high priest, but he's more than a high priest. The crown adds a royal quality to his role. Now he must back away again and understand that prophecies typically apply or even happen in the era they are given, and then again later under different circumstances. Thus, the symbolism of Joshua receiving that crown could only be carried out so far, but no farther. Politically and socially, there is no way Joshua could have donned a crown of royalty and survived any more than could have Zerubbabel. But clearly, when we understand that it is not the action that followed, but rather the symbolism that's the point, then we get it, that the future Messiah was to be a priest king, a combination of high priest and royal king. As modern believers, when reading this passage, can we legitimately attach a future nature to what is happening here? Or would we only be anachronistically attaching what we are told in the New Testament about Yeshua's future return to Zechariah's prophecy? Before we get there, recall that this is not the first time in Zechariah that the term Zemach has been used. In chapter 3, we first hear about this branch or shoot, Zechariah 3, 8 through 10. Listen, Kohen HaGadol, Joshua, both you and your colleagues seated here before you, because these men are a sign that I'm going to bring my servant Zemach. For look at the stone I have put in front of Yahshua, On one stone are seven eyes. We'll engrave what is to be written on it, says Adonai Zevaot, and I will remove the guilt of this land in one day. And when that time comes, says Adonai Zevaot, you will all invite each other to join you under your vines and fig trees. Okay. This is obviously a future event. It's the days of Zechariah. And just as obviously, there is a relationship between Joshua the high priest and the future branch or shoot, the Messiah. It is not that Joshua is the Messiah. He only typifies him. Later in other books, we'll read prophecies about Messiah that says he will be a scion, that is a royal offspring, a descendant of King David. So, David also typifies Messiah, even though David himself is not the Messiah. It is Joshua together with David that gives us the fuller picture of the purpose and the nature and the work of that coming Messiah. The crown upon the typified Messiah, the high priest Joshua says, the Messiah will retain the role of high priest. But that role will be expanded what it had been historically, just as Joshua's was. And be aware that the Jewish Targum and the ancient Aramaic translation of this passage both read, "Behold a man, Messiah is his name, and who is to be revealed." In other words, it was recognized early on among Jewish scholars and sages that Tzemach could only be speaking about the Messiah. But there's more that confirms the future nature of this event, such that while part of the fulfillment will occur immediately for Zechariah when he places that crown before Joshua, again, mostly symbolic of what will happen far later, other parts of the prophecy did not and have not yet occurred. Towards the end of verse 12, it says, he will sprout up from his place and rebuild the temple of Adonai. Or in a better, more fully literal translation, it says, the branch shall branch out from the place where he is, and he shall build the temple of Yahweh. The point is, it is the branch or shoot that is going to rebuild the temple. Therefore, this action cannot be contemporary with Zechariah, since by the time of this prophecy, the temple has almost been completely rebuilt. And because God said that the newly rebuilt temple is to be credited to Zerubbabel, and over the next few centuries, it would be alternately damaged and then improved several times until that fateful day it was fully destroyed by the Romans in 70 AD and has yet to be rebuilt. That means the temple this passage is speaking about is still future to us. Now let's take this up one more level. The temple that the Romans destroyed was the second temple, Zerubbabel's temple. Now, although centuries later, King Herod had greatly improved it, expanded its grounds so magnificently to the point that it became known worldwide as Herod's temple, it was nonetheless but the second temple. So the next temple to be built, which is yet to happen, will be the third. Is that what is being contemplated that Tzemach will build? Well, that actually is fairly easily answered. Listen to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, starting in verse 1. But in connection with the coming of our Lord Yeshua the Messiah and our gathering together to meet him, we ask you, brothers, not to be easily shaken in your thinking or anxious because of a spirit or a spoken message or a letter, supposedly from us, claiming that the day of the Lord has already come. Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for the day will not come until after the apostasy has come, and the man who separates himself from Torah has been revealed, the one destined for doom. He will oppose himself to everything that people call a god or make an object of worship. He will put himself above them all so that he will sit in the temple of God and proclaim that he himself is God. So what we learn here is that before Yeshua, the Tzemach, returns, while the Antichrist still rules, a third temple will be built, because the Antichrist desecrates it. Then afterwards, Armageddon happens. Now, considering what Ezekiel has to say about the amazing coming temple, along with what Zechariah just said, then the temple that the branch, the Messiah, will build must be a fourth temple. Although we don't find specific mention of the destruction of the third temple, we do know that Jerusalem and much of Israel will be decimated in an end times war. It's not imaginable to me the Messiah is going to repair and rebuild a temple that the Antichrist had brought into existence in order to glorify himself. So to sum it up, a temple to Jehovah will be built by who? By the returned Yeshua. And it is the temple that is best known as the millennial temple that is described in detail in 8 consecutive chapters of the book of Ezekiel, beginning with chapter 40. Let's move on to Zechariah. Zechariah 6:13. Yes, he will rebuild the temple of Adonai, and he will take up royal splendor, sitting and ruling from his throne. There will be a Cohen before his throne, and they will accept each other's advice in complete harmony. I'm afraid the complete Jewish Bible does a less than stellar job with this verse. Here it is more literally. Yes, he doth build the temple of Jehovah, and he doth bear away honor, and he hath sat and ruled on his throne, and he hath been a priest on his throne, and a council of peace is between both. One of the first issues to address is that the temple the branch is going to construct is not a rebuild. It's a new build. Thus, this will not be a repair, not an expansion of the previous temple, but rather a wholly new one. The second issue is that the branch, agreed that it is the Messiah, is going to sit on the throne. And as this and other prophecies imply, the throne will be in the temple, not in a separate palace. Then there is this strange wording about a priest on the throne and a peaceful harmony between them. And between the two, they will rule and reign, meaning operating the justice system. And just as with the situation with Joshua as high priest, who also bears the uncharacteristic responsibility for judging the people, even wearing a sword of crown, we find it similarly with the coming branch. Admittedly, it is hazy about exactly how all this works, what it will look like, because a most delicate balance is to be achieved. This verse uses grammar that mixes the singular with the plural. That is, on the one hand, it appears that there will be two figures at the throne of the new temple, one a priest, the other royalty. But on the other hand, two people cannot occupy the same throne simultaneously. Quite mysterious. Of course, mystery is the nature of prophecy, especially since it always combines separate, near-term, and far-term fulfillments. See, the thing is, Joshua, even with bearing a measure of judicial authority that a high priest didn't usually have, in no way was to be seen as a monarch. The high priest never sits upon a throne. But the Zamach, the shoot, or the branch, will be a monarch. And this is verified because it is said that he will sit upon a throne. Thus, in rather typical prophetic style, we find that the first fulfillment of a prophecy will always have the least scope and completeness of all its elements, but a later fulfillment will have a much broader scope and greater completeness. Joshua the high priest is the first fulfillment. The returned Messiah Yeshua will be the final fulfillment with the greatest scope, the highest level of completeness of this prophecy. One final thing for today that is most interesting and revealing. When this verse speaks of the branch as ruling, it uses the Hebrew root word mashal. But there's another common Hebrew verb in the Bible that is equally translated as to rule. And it comes from the root word melech. Now, when we do a word study, we find that in reference to all the kings that come from King David's line, the verb mashal is used only of David, Solomon, and Hezekiah. What makes them unique is that their rule extended beyond the historical borders of Israel. That is, these kings were monarchs over territory and people Israel had won in battle. A territory that is more than what was naturally theirs. When Yahweh's rule over all the earth is discussed, it too uses the verb mashal. However, when the verb melech is used to denote rule, it is of a king over his own natural territory and people. Bottom line, this is just another intricate validation that just as Jehovah is declared ruler over all the earth, so will Yeshua, the branch, become ruler over all the earth as his father's agent during the period of the millennial kingdom. Okay, we'll close here, and next week complete chapter 6 and get into chapter 7.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.